This is GeekSpeak. Today's episode, Public Domain Brains Program Siri.
Digital assistants talking gooder, EU legislating worser, long copyright worstest, cryptocurrencies downing, and spaceships farthest. These stories and more as the geeks critique each other's communication skills and discuss the ability to excel in various areas, including programming through nurture versus nature.
This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. Hello, Miles. Welcome.
How's it going?
Brian Young, a software engineer, full-time. Welcome.
Why, thank you. It's awesome to be here.
And also Mr. Ben Jaffe, also software engineer. Wow, we've got a full cadre of software engineers.
Hi, Ben. A full stack? Hey. Did you
a full try stack. Full stack of programmers. Is that what a collective plural noun for programmers is? A stack of programmers? I think a stack of engineers is good. And of course, it's a byte of geeks. I think we determined
it's
that
a byte
ago.
Of geeks?
Yeah.
No.
What would you say?
Absolutely not, unless there are eight.
Well, what if you have
you to... can't have a byte of seven? I mean, like,
you have a byte of anything.
You can have a byte of anything, sure. Yeah, but not really. Like, technically, yes, you have trinary and all of that esoteric stuff. But like
a pedantic of geeks, is that more appropriate?
What? Oh God, God, you are the one asking. What is the proper term?
That's true, Brian. Thank you for being here. You haven't been here for a while. You've been job searching. You're now a full-time iOS engineer. You're working on Swift.
I'm working on Swift and Objective-C.
Oh, a mix.
And JavaScript today.
Got to do it all. What's your back-end stuff? Or you don't touch that stuff?
Well, excuse me?
No, this show's getting off to a rocky start.
When I do UI engineering and I do iOS and some jobs with JavaScript and Objective-C, and the back-end system is Groovy.
Yeah, the server APIs are all written in Ruby and various other tools on the back-end.
But you're not writing those things?
No.
Oh. Very lucky. I'm jealous.
Now
again.
I get to go to ask somebody, can you put this in there?
So you have a public service announcement for us today.
I do. I mean, it's been 6 months since I've been here. A lot of things have happened, including I upgraded to iPhone 10, I think around about the time that I was last on the show. And I've learned something. The nice smooth sides of that iPhone 10 fit really nice into my little bracket that holds it on my dashboard. And I can't leave it sitting straight up because it starts to slide down through the mount. So what I learned was while we were driving, my family and I, and the iPhone starts screaming a horrible sound, that if I let it slide down enough where it will hold the volume and the power button together, it will call 911 for me with no interaction.
Really?
It will. Absolutely did.
What?
Well, so what does it do? What do you mean screaming?
Well, it puts this horrible alert sound that you're about to call 911. And of course you scramble. Well, in this case, my wife, who's the passenger, scrambles to try to stop it from doing it. Once this begins, are you going to do this?
Yeah, we'll go ahead and do it. Okay, here. I'm pressing
once
right.
Once this begins, you wait. Cannot cancel it. So... Oh. If you,
I canceled it the other day when it happened to me. Now I'm scared.
No, once the call is initiated, there's, I think, a 5 second delay okay. between the
we'll
sound.
Do, we'll just where do you... the 5 second delay thing.
That's a photo, Lyle. You took a screenshot.
Okay.
Okay, you were able to stop that 1 second before
it... I actually think I stopped it because I released the two buttons.
Yeah.
I don't think I could have stopped without releasing two buttons. So
you were trying to tap on the screen.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, and that's what we were trying to do. We tried tapping on the screen to cancel the call. And the funny part, well, it wasn't that funny, but once the call was initiated, we couldn't cancel it. Once the dispatcher came through the speakers is when my wife was finally able to tap it to cut it off.
And so, you hung up on them?
So what we got was, hello, this is 911. And we responded, I'm sorry, click. And of course, we're in the dead spot in Boulder Creek, so we had to drive a little bit further before I can call them back and say, hey.
Did they call you back? Or you
no,
called
no.
Them back?
Luckily, I think they heard enough that they knew that that wasn't intended. But he told me they had not yet sent down any cars to investigate. But they, of course, would have known exactly where we were.
Really?
Yeah. It sends the location.
GPS location.
Yeah.
Well, that's like a nice feature.
It's a nice feature, unless you just let the thing slide down in your bracket and you don't expect it.
That's how you turn the phone off. The iPhone X, you can't turn off without doing that, without getting to that mode. You just hold them both down before the timer counts down. You let go, and then you can push hang up or turn off the phone.
Anyways, my public service announcement is when you hear that sound, just wait talk to the dispatcher, apologize, and don't hang up on them, please.
Thank you for the public service announcement. Miles, you also have a public story.
Yes, public domain. Copyright rules. Every 20 years or so...
when they're about to elapse.
When Steamboat Willie, also known as the precursor to Mickey Mouse, is about to fall out of copyright and go into the public domain.
Which means that anybody could actually draw Mickey Mouse and sell it on anything, and there'd be no ownership of that artwork.
Iterations of it that are based upon the original artwork, not the more recent iterations.
And not the trademarked versions as well that are
right.
Used
trademark
for
remains the same. It's different rules. But coincidentally, around that time, a whole bunch of Congress people are encouraged by industry to please retroactively extend copyright. And this happened in the 90s. It happened, you know, again later. And just when it looks like, oh, hey, looks like we're going to get stuff in public domain again, no, we're not. In fact, the current bill that's going through Congress is pushing for no public domain until 2067.
So what's the metric they're using? Is this based on years after the death of the creator?
Yes, in most cases, yeah. It varies depending upon the scenario. But that's the funny thing about copyright. There's a good reason to have it, which is you want someone to be able to say, this is something that I have created, and they can, you know, make a business on it or put their name behind it to build a reputation. And they are given a certain amount of time. When the country was founded, or shortly after the country was founded, it was 27 years total from the time of creation to when it lapsed. And when it lapsed, it went into public domain. Anyone could use it, riff on it. It didn't protect against plagiarism, but over time, that has gotten longer and longer to the point where they started having, I believe in the 70s, these retroactive amendments where existing copyrighted items were then made so they wouldn't expire for another 20, 25 years. Copyright is great in terms of rewarding the author, but that's how the incentive works. If the work is already created, the incentive model breaks down. There's no incentive to create something that is already created.
Right.
Although there is incentive to cash in on things you will create now for long after your death. In other words, creating a corporation.
And that's the thing, is that already we had copywritten works that someone could be, for example, taking the Steamboat Willie or Mickey Mouse example, someone could have been born after Mickey Mouse was copywritten.
Like me.
Yes. Live a full life where you live not just the average human lifespan, but a very healthy lifespan, and die, and never having seen this work in the public domain. You might be thinking, what's the problem with that? Well, Mickey Mouse, among other things, is part of our culture now. Once something has been around for a while, especially when we grow up with it, it becomes part of our culture. So to have...
Especially the Constitution is very clear about this copyright concept that it has a limited duration.
Yes.
And limited duration cannot mean longer than a citizen lives. Like, that's not limited at all.
That's actually up for debate, because the Supreme Court, back when this was being debated in the 90s, the Sonny Bono Copyright Act, they were saying... when people were saying this is going on too long, this is not a limited time, it's just being retroactively created for eternity, the Supreme Court countered with, well, what is limited time? Does this particular extension amount to an unlimited time? And what is an unlimited time? What makes something limited? And a whole bunch of wordplay. And I think it does apply to, if it's longer than a human lifetime, then that is effectively unlimited.
Yeah.
But that has not been codified into law,
yeah,
or into jurisprudence.
So to bring this back to tech a little bit, so obviously, I mean, this is commercial interest over cultural needs of our society. But when the copyright was starting to be extended, when Disney was starting to lobby heavily to keep their ownership of this, we were in a time period where media was growing up and going from being something that was in the early stages to something that was big business and is growing into the corporations we see now. And the reason why I want to bring this back to tech is because I think that you can look at the internet and the web and see the same sort of maturation that's starting to happen as commercial interests are really starting to try to angle for what they want and change what the original idea of the people that have been creating the web had in mind. And so just because the web is the way it is now doesn't mean it always will be.
And that actually brings up an interesting point. Think of the mid to late 90s when Adobe Flash was first being created, and you actually had to have a pretty fast modem connection to even see some of those early movies that you waited 3 minutes and then finally this interactive, you know, comic book graphic would go on or something like that. Those things are under copyright. And so legally, you cannot copy them without permission. Some of them are not online anymore. Maybe you'd have to hunt for them. The thing behind copyright is right now, even before this extension, if it ever took, if it goes through, takes place, if you got to the point where you ended copyright and then said, oh, now I have access to this work that was done before, that was in Flash, you may not have a computer that could run the software that could run this piece of media, so it is effectively lost in much the same way as movies that have been locked away in a vault that have never been seen and cannot be accessed because of copyright law. The film degrades. And so it is effectively a death sentence for that media, no matter how interesting it may be for cultural historians.
In regards to copyright, kind of, there's a European Union is updating their 2001 copyright directive with a whole bunch of changes and committee input and stuff. But they have one really stupid proposal. It's called Article 13. And it says that any site that allows public to post anything – so we're talking – anything social media based, right?
Anything with comments or input.
Comments or inputs or uploads
or uploads.
Yeah, anywhere of that nature. The site itself is going to be required to run software that will detect for copyright material and ban the posts based off of that. So YouTube does that right now with YouTube videos, right? They have a whole system that tries to detect copyright material. And that's
media
how,
fingerprinting kind of stuff.
Yeah. So if you use a song that is known in their system to be owned by somebody else, you can't then make a commercial endeavor on that Facebook – on that YouTube video. And, of course, that YouTube video's proceeds will actually go to the musician that owned the copyright on it. And this has some problems with it in the sense that you could theoretically create content that's similar enough that's your own work that the system still thinks is somebody else's work and get it banned, or somebody else can try to claim a copyright on your work.
I had actually a good example of this where I was brushing my teeth with my electric toothbrush. And Google thought that it was a song. And I listened to the song, and sure enough, the very beginning of the song is like... Mm-hmm.
Were you trying to post something, or were you
just... No. It was just listening in the background, because it does that. I have the audio fingerprinting thing on, because it's an interesting feature. But yeah, like, there's all kinds of false positives.
We've had copyright claims on the sound of the universe with Static. So just Static has been copyrighted on YouTube.
A copyright challenge, yeah.
Yeah.
Ambulance sounds have been marked a lot. Things like...
As from songs that have ambulances?
No, not from songs, but from sound effects packs.
Yes.
That have sounds of ambulances in them.
Which, of course, those sound effects are copyrighted. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. But it's also worth noting that even though YouTube has this content ID technology, it's just for videos and audio. And the Article 13 is talking about text, pictures, videos, games, sounds, code, and like especially with games or code, like that's really hard to enforce, like even to detect. I mean,
right. The other thing that's really challenging about this is that the claim of the copyright, there's no like giant known database of copyright, right? It's basically whoever makes the claim, and after that point, you are the claimant. And people have to prove that you're not. So it would be very easy for me to go and find a GitHub repo, like one of Miles's PostgreSQL repos, and claim copyright on that in their system. And then if Miles tries to post parts of his code, he'd then have to take me to court to take it down. Like It's not a viable way of declaring who owns something.
Wait, is this new law having to take to court? Because currently you don't have to take to court.
This is the new law of Article 13 of the European Union's update to the 2001 Copyright Act. It's just a really bad article. So there's a real intent right now from a few different groups to get rid of this and start, you know, blocking this from actually occurring.
Wow,
so
this
we'll
is
see what happens.
GDPR and then raising.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
So do you think there's any problem that this is trying to solve that's valid?
Well, I mean, it is tricky, of course, the process they're dealing with, because right now it's you post something and somebody else has to make a claim against you, and then there's like an endeavor. But if you have an automated system, the other point that they make about this is that if you're a small like blog posting site and you have to abide by this rules, you don't have the AI powerhouse that Google has to produce a system that actually can achieve any of this. So you're going to have to find some resource that will provide this for you. So what we talk about basically is the large tech companies that can spend millions of dollars on these kind of systems would have to process everybody's posts. And basically you'd have real centralized ideas of who owns what copyright. It would basically be Google, right? Like that's who'd own it. And of course probably the larger companies like Facebook and Twitter would also probably write their own systems that would be applicable.
So in an effort to protect creators and encourage people to make money off of their creations, they're shutting down any possibility for small creators to grow into larger creators.
Yeah. I mean, a small startup wouldn't be able to do this.
Really well summarized. Yeah.
So there's a suggestion. There's a tool to tweet your call or to, you know, basically add to this. If you're part of the European Union, I urge you to look this up. You can find it, of course, up at geekspeak.org. Brian, we had WWDC last week or 2 weeks ago. I can't recall when.
It was last week. It was a long week.
And a few things have been shared with updates to the OS and such, and you're excited about one?
Okay. So there's, as always, with this time of year where we have Google I/O and Microsoft's Build and then Apple's WWDC conference, there's lots of new technologies that are coming out. This is a bit of a different year for Apple. There's plenty of people that are happy that they're not making as many big announcements as they have before, because there's plenty of people hoping that they clean up their systems a little bit and have fewer bugs. The one big thing that they announced this year that I wanted to talk about is it's pretty interesting to me. So voice assistants have been around now since, Siri started them and then quickly fell behind as Amazon Alexa and Google came out with their systems. And one of the things that has really held Siri back in being useful is that nobody can build other actions that Siri can do until, was it last year or was it 2 years ago that they had a very limited expansion of that?
I think last year they did some expansions of intents.
So
the intent basically means like I want it to do something and there's a trigger word or a trigger phrasing that allows me to run a command, like add these two numbers together.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Right. So Apple has not opened their system up very much at all. And one of the big tensions here is the fact that Apple has this big initiative, this big culture of trying to keep data private for the users. So they don't want to have large web services that hold lots of data if they can help it because of that viewpoint, which, of course, is exactly how Google and Amazon run their services. And all of the extensions that are made for those are run in the cloud. They're not run on the local device in your house. So what Apple announced this year was something that approach to solve this problem so that Apple users can have all these cool little things that you're seeing made for Alexa.
No, hang on a second, though, because Siri right now does require internet access. So clearly there's some of the processes is happening in the cloud environment. What you're saying is that there's not a large database of your voice stuff in
right.
the cloud with Siri.
Right.
So
all of these services, you use the server for voice recognition after you get past that trigger word. But beyond that, it's what you do with collecting data to be useful. So with Google, you tie into all of the calendar and contacts and all the other services that you have in the cloud. With Amazon as well, they're holding records of you, of your shopping history, of your contacts in order to be able to make sense of all these requests that you might make. So Apple has obviously been reluctant to that. So what I found really interesting about this is they came at this problem differently. And when When Silicon Valley's at its best and when Apple's at their best, they back up and they try to figure out what problem they're trying to solve. So voice assistants have some inherent problems. People can't remember very many commands that they can use on their voice assistants. And tell me what your experience is, but I don't think people usually use maybe 3 or 4 commands and that's it.
Yeah.
I use like make a call and take a note. I think that might be it.
Yeah.
Turn on the lights.
Reminders.
Turn off the lights.
You have that set up in your house?
Yeah.
So
he has an ability to turn off his fireplace and turn on his fireplace from an open HTTP port.
No, I don't because it broke.
Oh, okay.
I didn't fix it. Yeah, that was fun. I secured it.
Okay, good.
I secured it after you put it on the show. Thanks.
Well, since it doesn't work anymore, it's very secure.
Well, I think it doesn't work.
Do you use
the
a Google Home?
Thing might still
or
be plugged in. Actually,
do you use a Google Home or an Alexa thing? Or
yeah, Google.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, go on, Brian.
Okay. Anyways, so what they did to solve this, to take a look at this problem was that people can't remember this stuff. So how do you make it discoverable? There's nothing to see. You don't get prompted by, you wouldn't want to be prompted by your voice assistants. You don't want them asking you questions. Do you want to do this, this, and this? So what they did is attacked not only the voice assistant problem, but also attacked another problem with specifically iOS, which is how do you automate the system? And the solution they came up with, I don't know if it's going to solve everything that that both Alexa and Google Home can do, but it definitely goes a long way, and it keeps everything on device. So what they're doing is any app can now tie into the system and offer what they call intents, but offer a thing that can be done. So if I have a example at the show is if you have a soup app and you want to be able to order soup, you can put into the system that you can order soup through this through Siri. Now, the user doesn't get that automatically. It's not like you automatically can just open up your phone and say, hey, order soup. What happens, though, is every time a user does order soup in their app, it's going to go ahead and note, oh, they ordered soup on Tuesday. It was tomato soup. Oh, they ordered soup on Thursday. It was clam chowder. And after enough of these, the system will then turn around and suggest, you know, it's Tuesday. I bet you would like some tomato soup. So Siri will suggest these in various places on your watch, on the lock screen.
But it won't order soup for you. It'll kind of say, this is a thing that you seem to be doing for yourself. And so now you can do it via voice.
And now you can do it by answering Siri on your phone. So on the lock screen, on your watch, and also, if you want to, you can go into the system and see all the possible things that you can do and say, I want to make a shortcut for this. So I want to say, it's soup time.
So the app can say, ordering soup is a capability this app can do. And these are all the types of soups. And then the system kind of watched that those intents might have been triggered by you using the app normally. And then builds a library of things that might be good vocal commands for you to represent those things you've already been doing.
Exactly.
Well, see, that does seem like a thing that would be more useful because the times I want Siri is when I keep on doing the same thing over and over again. I'm like, oh, right. This was easier.
And that makes it more memorable, too, because it's kind of coming from you. I mean, it's not really.
Well, no,
but it's like when you want to convince someone to do something, you don't convince them to do it. You convince them that it was their idea in the first place. Right? It's kind of what Siri is doing.
You work at a large company.
Right.
So, interesting. Okay, so you could then say, I want soup, and Siri might say, tomato soup? Or because the developer might have offered a few choices and then Siri would ask you a question potentially?
Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, it's to the point where if there is no question that evolves out of this conversation, it can do everything in the background. It doesn't have to open up the app.
Really?
Of course, the app is launching. The app is running in the background. The developer of the app can put in whatever logic is required to take care of this. But
is it similar to the background notification system in the
exactly.
sense that from an app developer? Nice.
Exactly. But so what's really interesting about this is because of how prevalent voice assistants are and how much people want these things to grow into something that's useful, if apps do start implementing this left and right, and a lot of apps have these intents are the word they use. All of a sudden, you also have an entire automation system that's laid out that they have a app that will come out in the App Store after the next launch called Shortcuts that can tie into each and every one of these. And all of a sudden, what was a very locked down system that if you wanted to do tasks, you had to do them manually and go through every app to do it, is now a system that has all of these actions that can be strung together and feed into each other, and potentially a really powerful automation system on your phone or on your iPad.
Triggered only by Siri and only integrated with Siri? With other
no,
as
no.
Well?
It can be triggered through the UI of this Shortcuts app. It's basically workflow.
Right. I mentioned workflow a couple episodes ago as an app that I really like to use. And what they've basically done is integrate that into the operating system more discreetly, more directly.
Yeah. Well, through these Siri intents, there are all these hooks into all the apps that implement it.
And so cool.
Yeah. If this is if this is taken to the degree that I hope it is, that it looks like there's a reason to take it to this degree, we're going to have a very robust automation system as well.
So every week I take a whole bunch of audio files and I put them on my computer. For years I was doing it this way. I've tried different ways lately. And after moving those files to the computer, I open up certain folders, I open up certain web pages. It's like I do all this stuff repetitively every week, right? You'd think over time my machine would be like, this is the time he's doing this thing. Now, of course, I could script that discreetly. But it'd be so much better if the system was looking at what I was doing and over time was like, this is the time when he does this, and just set myself up with the screens I normally set up and kind of did it for me. So this is kind of the start of that.
It is the start of that. So the system is going to monitor enough that if it sees a pattern, it can start suggesting it. And it's not immediately going to build a 10-step
right.
automation out of what it sees you do. But you would have the option to string some of these things together in the Shortcuts app. So right. that when it asks you, I just saw four audio files in this folder. Do you want me to blah, blah, blah?
Right. It's interesting because, of course, this would be extremely creepy if this data was all being taken off your machine. But the thing with Apple that they've done in their operating system, both of them, is actually put in a whole bunch of machine learning on the device. So these models are actually being trained on your own phone, which basically means the data doesn't have to leave your phone for the system to work, which is pretty cool. I am curious, though, when you upgrade your phone, if that's going to transfer between devices, because they have traditionally not done that kind of thing easily.
Well, what they don't traditionally do, and this is seen best in the Photos app, is all the machine learning face detection that is done in the background on your iOS device and on your Mac, they don't sync that up. That file stays separate, and each device has to do it on its own. That's syncing between devices. But if you were to back up your iPhone and then get another iPhone and install from that backup, all of that's going to be carried forward.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Brian. That's Siri Kit, if you want to look more about it. Ben?
Speaking of home assistants, I did want to mention something I recently discovered. I think it's actually a new feature. If you have a Google Home, you can say the trigger word. I don't want to trigger everyone's things. Turn on the lights and play music. You can chain them together. You can string them together with "and." The most useful is when you ask it a question, like, what's the weather? And then it says, then you turn around and you say, volume 6, what's the weather? And it works.
That's nice.
It was infuriating before.
I bet.
Such a long...
A little mumbling.
Yeah, long interaction.
So, Ben... Earlier, before the other geek showed up, we were talking about an idea of what kind of person can program, what kind of brain can program.
Can you
phrase that for us?
Yeah. I posed the question because I've thought about this a lot, having done ed tech and whatnot.
Educational technology.
Educational technology.
Where were you working before
again? Udacity.
Udacity, yes.
Yeah. They do online courses for how to learn programming. And the question that I've often thought of is, can anyone learn to program? And my gut says, yeah, of course anyone can learn to program. But it raises the, I guess, follow-up question for me of, like, how much is it someone's, like, the way that someone's brain is organized, let's say at age 20, based on, you know, nature and nurture and whatnot, versus the amount of work that they put in. Because you have some people who learn to program, they're extremely intrinsically motivated, they pick it up very quickly, they go into a career. And then you have other people who try pretty hard and they struggle, and they really, really struggle with it. And they can push through and get it, but it takes more effort. So that was the question that I posed to you.
Yeah. I you know, of course, only know who I am and the people I know that are programmers, kind of a little bit of their story. But I recall as a child, I had a bit of a tendency to, I would say this was like when I'm 7 to 12, somewhere in that time frame, if I kind of an OCD pattern where if I touch something with one hand, I'd touch something with another hand. And I'd kind of keep patterns kind of regular in how I interacted.
Like you had to be balanced. It's like the 1 foot in one square on the sidewalk, and then you got to put the other foot in the other square kind of thing.
And that's, you know, I'm not sure clinically what all that's about, but I recall the experience of being very much like thinking about every action and how I affect the world with my actions, and then thinking about how things feel and making sure the feeling's the same on both sides, bilaterally on my body, thinking about how I affect the world and how the world affects me, but also very categorically doing things, like understanding it kind of also related to different sounds, how different sounds worked in the world, static versus a thump. So it was just I was always analyzing that kind of thing, just regularly thinking about that kind of stuff a lot. I wasn't vocal until I was like 6. And so that feels very similar to the way I think about when I'm programming, where I'm trying to comprehend a very large complexity and I'm putting it into little categories and putting it in the place of my mind so that I can think about how it interacts with itself. It has the same type of texture, mental texture to it.
So in a similar way as you would organize the world throughout your entire life, you kind of organize the world of the code that you're looking at,
yes,
the concepts that you're grappling with.
Brian and Miles and Ben too, please, what are you guys' feeling on why it is that you can program? What is it about your mind, if you think your mind correlates well to programming?
I'm going to jump in here, but it's a funny thing for me because I grew up with these people that I considered really smart. All my friends were children of parents of NSA or Air Force or engineers, and they went on through high school to do calculus and other higher math, and went on to university studying architecture and engineering, and one disassembles airplanes now for enemy caught airplanes. So I always felt like I was just the artist and didn't think this way, and I wasn't smart enough to do any of these things. And here I am at 45, starting my first programming career.
But you've programmed other times.
I've programmed all through my life, but I didn't consider that I had what it took to be a professional engineer or a programmer. So I told myself I couldn't. So what is it about me that could do it? I can recognize a lot of the same things you just said, thinking about things as a system, thinking things how they connect. When I think about one thing, how does it affect the other? So maybe that's where it really sits. Or are there programmers that are laser focused on just some areas and they don't think of it as a large system? I don't know.
Miles?
I categorically disavow the concept of a brain that can program. I don't think that it's a thing. I first took computer science AP in high school. I didn't do well, but I did reasonably well in math when I was younger, but then had a bit of a hiccup when I was in high school with it. And as time went on, when I took computer science classes in college, I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't like doing this. I was okay at it, but wasn't particularly good. And it's like, I don't want to do this for a living. This is horrible. That was my thought process at the time. And over time, I had a particular application that I wanted to do, you know, make a web page or write some app for a friend, something like that. And, you know, that early code, if you look at it, was horrible. I mean, it was beginner code. And I remember the exercises for intro to programming and think now, and it's a 5-minute exercise now as part of a major program, but the intro to programming, I remember being at the time feeling like this is kind of hard. I need to spend some time and effort to try to get this 50-line program to work.
It's so funny because the 20 years I've known you, I have thought of you as like really good at programming just inherently.
Yeah, and the way that I think of programming is while there is that logical step and learning how to do logic in much the same way that someone goes into math where you learn logical steps and the like, is that it's not – there are some people that it's inherent. You know, luminaries within mathematics like Gauss, you know, they're on a different level. It's not what you compare to the average person when you look at
– They're smelling numbers and stuff, right? Like they're using extra senses.
Well, Gauss was just a giant. Like he just came up with stuff that, you know, at 5 years old going like, what? He did what? You know, and I don't consider him to be the norm or what we should use as a basis for comparing ourselves in much the same way that I wouldn't want to compare what I learned in terms of the piano, long forgotten piano lessons, to Mozart. Like you can't compare yourself to the greatest composers in human history, you know?
Can we move to a shift?
So just to finish off with that is that I see programming as like learning a human language. I don't consider like going from one programming language to another as being human languages. I think that's actually a shorter distance. But that concept of learning to think as discrete steps and logic, I believe is much the same thing as I'm learning Spanish. And the more time you put into it, the more it becomes natural to you and the more patterns you see. And yes, there are going to be some people who are better at it than others, and just like there are some people who are better writers than others. But by and large, it's a learnable trait.
So I want to ask a bit more about that. So you said at the beginning that you categorically disagree with the idea that there are brains that can program and brains that can't. But if we take away the far edges of that, do you believe that there is a gradient of people who have more of an aptitude or less of an aptitude, but everyone has the capacity? Or is it more about everyone is kind of at the same starting point and you just have to find whatever your particular relationship is to it?
I believe that there are some people who really have a hard time doing math that have diagnosed dyscalculia.
Sure.
Yeah. and there are people that I've met that just – it doesn't matter. They've put in the effort and it just doesn't click for them. There's something how they're wired. But there are a huge number of people that just have math anxiety. And I don't mean to diminish that to say just math anxiety. It's a real thing. It does negatively affect the psyche.
Just arachnophobia. Just get over it. No.
But it's
<They're> spiders.
Not, it's not something that where their brain is broken. It's their interaction with the subject has become toxic in some way or hurtful in some way.
Right.
And I see the same thing with regard to programming. And yes, there is going to be a wide variance, just in the same way that there are some people who are going to be better at public speaking than others. But I believe that everyone can learn to overcome their fear to stand up at a podium and give a speech. Even if some people are noticeably better at the public speaking and delivery and engaging the audience than
others. So you think what the brain can do is fundamentally different than what the body can do? Meaning I cannot – my physical body, without excessive training, we'll never be able to be like a 24-hour runner, right? I mean, there's certain things about my body type that will not allow me to do certain things that I'll never be able to jump Olympic distances, no matter how much I train. But you think that the body's one thing, but the brain is different. The brain can – anybody can flex in any ability.
That's not what I'm getting.
No.
Because you can't – so you can't run Olympic distances and you can't jump 30 feet, but you can run and you can jump. So –
And you can improve at how well you run and improve at how well you jump.
Right. But you'll never be Gauss or you'll never be an Olympic athlete with it, probably.
So I guess then this naturally comes down to what do you mean by someone who can program, Ben?
Oh, I don't have an answer for that. I really don't. I guess – well, I don't know. I could talk about kind of my thoughts about that. I wanted to hear what you had to say, though, Miles, first.
Well, there's a distinction I also make between someone who is trying to be successful in computer science academia, pushing a boundary, and there are many people there that are doing things that I believe are outside the capabilities of most people. At the same time, I think of working everyday programmers, the vast majority of us in this field, we are connecting one API to another. We are not reinventing storage technologies. We're not reinventing the algorithm to calculate. We're not reinventing quantum algorithms. And so that's where I make that distinction of saying, yes, just because you're not someone who is making the new storage model that's going to make NoSQL obsolete, let alone relational databases, doesn't mean that you aren't that bell-shaped curve is extremely large. And I don't think you should just dismiss people because they're not at the highest level.
But
the same way that I don't think that someone should be dismissed because just because they're literate, but they're not a published like great American author.
Well, let's take something that you've done recently, like when I mentioned earlier, your index generator out of string or string index generator, or you made a library in PostgreSQL we talked about in a show a while ago for dealing with having UUIDs that are short, right?
Oh, for threaded discussion forums, yeah.
Okay, so let's take someone who did okay in math. You know, they got to be in high school math, and then in college they did fine. You know, mm-hmm. not the bottom of the class, not the top of the class, but they're okay. But they've never done any programming at all. How long would it take them to get to the point where they understood what we just said? Probably about a half an hour, right? Just understanding what we said. Maybe a couple hours.
Understanding what we mean
when we just talk about understanding the basics of the problem space and like what problem you're trying to solve and roughly how you solved it.
I would think it would take longer than that.
How long would it take for someone to do what you did?
It depends upon the person. It depends upon what their focus is. Just if you were to say, like, take 20-year-old Miles and say, how long would it take for him to figure out how to do this task? Just as a straight value?
Well, it took 20 years for you to do that because you just did it last year.
No, it took 20 years for me to get to a point where I went, hey, this is an interesting problem to solve.
Okay.
But that's not necessarily how long it took me to actually do it.
Well, I'm talking about someone who's never programmed before. Getting the knowledge necessary to do a recreation, a new idea that you did.
Well, I feel like we don't want to conflate the are you able to accomplish tasks someone tells you to do versus are you able to see that accomplishing this task could benefit you in some way, right? Like one would be more like examining the larger problem space of an area and then deciding that you want to solve this particular problem. Another could be like a junior engineer intern who just got hired at a place and their manager is like, hey, we got to solve this problem. You know, here's the problem. You solve it.
Yeah.
So like, I guess, which are we talking about?
I think we're talking about the general idea that it is a problem because you have to understand how databases work and you have to understand needs of those things and having keys that are short. I mean, there's all this stuff you need to know to even want to have that problem solved and then implementing that problem. What language do you choose to implement that in? C?
This particular thing was in C, yeah.
Right. And I think of other things you did recently as well of like taking advantage of Find and grep to do a PostgreSQL pointer to a folder directory, right? These kind of concepts – a layman, like a programmer right out of school, cannot do those things yet, even though they can program. So I was trying to get to that point where you're like, Gauss is amazing. Look at his brain. Yeah, but somebody else could say the same thing about you. So you just – this problem space looks simpler to you because you understand so much of it. But when you really try to teach someone what you know, we're talking 20 years.
I don't believe that it would take 20 years for this particular thing. I believe it would be much less. And I do liken it to if you are learning a new language. If someone says, I want you to read Dostoevsky in the original Russian, that's going to take me a while. Yeah. There's going to be the whole learning Russian part, the practicing, the knowing the history of the time when he wrote, and then actually tackling the subject material and having to get through that. And yes, it'll take some time, but it's not taking me time because I am smarter or dumber than another person. It's because it's a body of knowledge that you have to accumulate. And I don't believe it has to do directly with is my brain the type of brain that can understand Dostoevsky in Russian, in the original Russian?
Okay, so I want to move to the motivation aspect of it because I think that's a big problem space of this. When I was a kid, I had all these, I was a middle child and I had siblings that were doing different things, lots of performing arts and such. And I recall when arguments emerged, I was the person that started to solve those problems. And when I did technical things for the family, fixed a lamp cord or something, I got praise and love and attention. So over time, my service to other people in technology space, including theater spaces, became the way that I was identified in the family and became the way my support structure gave me kudos. So as things got – as I grew in my abilities to do things because I got older with more accumulated knowledge, that just became my pattern until finally at one point in my life, I had to make a conscious decision to stop solving problems for people. And I actually made a phrase that was about that as my password. So I'd type it down multiple times a day, a mantra, to just not necessarily be the one that came up with a solution for things because I wanted to detrain myself to do that. And so obviously that's what gave me the patience to learn technology. Brian, you were saying that it didn't come necessarily easy to you or it wasn't something you fell into and you thought maybe you couldn't do it. What got you to the point where you can? What allowed you to learn what Miles is saying is this large set of knowledge?
So I have, as you said, programmed most of my life. But that level of programming that I did was what we used to call scripting. It was not complex. It was not something that needed to last for somebody to come along and rejigger and make it work in another way. It was not something you handed off. So then you come 7 years ago where I decide all this stuff I've done in the past where I wanted to have apps that work the way I want them to work finally motivated me to the point where I said, I want to do this. I know how to program. I'm going to do this. I naively thought I could get to a point where I could have a career in it within a year or two. 7 years later, I'm finally to that point. And the body of knowledge I had to learn in that was just a matter of can I keep my interest level up and keep playing with this and keep learning more? And every time I uncover something that I want to do, can I learn that? And it reminds me of what I thought of school. I was always afraid of the next level of school. From elementary to go to junior high, I was afraid of that. Going from junior high to high school, I was really afraid of that. And what I learned every step was that it's really just another incremental step to the point where I was just not afraid of it in college, and I just kept taking harder and harder and harder things because it was fun. So I guess I had to get to that point where each one of these discoveries, each one of these next milestones was no longer a fear-based thing, something I didn't think I could do. It was just another step to go on.
So you tricked yourself into getting excited about it rather than scared about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Ben, so I think that's the answer to this. It's about the motivation the person has to take the time to learn the complexity, given that they don't have a lack of an ability, like you mentioned earlier, the inability to understand numbers. Like there is structures in the brain that will not allow you to do these kind of logic puzzles, I'm assuming. But how does that feel to you? Because earlier when you said to me earlier today, you said it feels right to say anybody can learn to program, but I'm not sure if that is right.
I don't like the that's the answer. I think that there's much more complexity here.
I guess that's my answer. I think that you have to have enough interest to get through all the difficulty of learning it.
I think that's a big part of it, definitely. Yeah. I mean, if we're acknowledging that some people just cannot, a minority, sure, but some people cannot. And some people are luminaries. And it's a small minority, but some people are luminaries. And then there's everyone else. I think that everyone else is spread across some sort of a gradient.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that, therefore, like, I don't think if we were to graph it out, I don't think it's two humps like a camel's back, right? I think it's more like a bell curve, like what you were alluding to, Miles, earlier, where most people are kind of in the same central area. And some people have a harder time and some people have an easier time. And then an additional factor is that depending on your upbringing, depending on your gender, the society you're raised in, the people who are around you, your socioeconomic status, all of these different things contribute to ultimately what your both ability to have access to it and your own motivation are. And then those things create the ultimately the person you become as you grow up. And then you come to this point where my question is asked. And you find that some people can't learn to program, but not because their brain is a certain way only, and not because their particular the way that they grew up, you know, makes it not okay or possible. But I think it's some sort of a combination or multiplication or reduction of all of these different things. Also, a big part of it is mindset. Like, I've taught programming in a number of different contexts, and it took me a really, really long time to really to come up with this metaphor that programming is playing with blocks. It's playing with Legos, right? It's the Legos are not physical. They're not all the same shapes, but you're ultimately taking different components and you're putting them together. And it's either libraries or APIs, or maybe you're actually working with an algorithm, in which case the pieces are smaller or the pieces are a little bit more, I don't know, primitive or something, you know? But ultimately, it's about playing with blocks and putting things together and wiring them up. And part of the job is learning about the blocks, but part of the job is having the curiosity to think, what can I make with the blocks? And what if I connect them in this other way? Or is there a better way to connect them?
Yeah, curiosity, and also just getting past... There is a certain self-preservation that people have to their own psyche. That you don't want to feel dumb. And therefore, if something comes across that you can't grasp immediately, you have two choices, or you have a couple of choices, a few choices. One of them is to say, I'm just too dumb, and quit. There's the, this is hard, so I'm just going to apply myself more to it, and just accept that some things are take effort. And there's the one that says, I'm not dumb. This thing, for whatever rationalization, just doesn't appeal to me. It's a stupid thing, or it's a something to allow you to keep your own positive self-image by shunting any negative thoughts off on the fault off on that other topic. And, you know, I mean, there are other variations there, but, and it's a real thing. And we do it all the time. All of us make selections, things that we choose to learn about, and other things that we, you know, kind of go, I don't have time for that. I'm not going to spend time on that.
I agree with that very much.
Do you ever think of problems where you go, oh, I'm not smart enough?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
One thing that in terms of computers that hit me, this was a little more than – or about 10 years ago. Git had just been announced by Linus Torvalds, and he had made this thing. And I had thought about the problem of how to do revision control. I had seen like Subversion. It took forever to – do a checkout and check in, wasted a whole bunch of space. And part of me had just accepted that's the way that revision control systems were, source control systems were. And Git was released, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then there was a description, like, one, I had a hard time using it. That's not an uncommon thing. A lot of people have a hard time using Git to this day, but especially compared to the earliest days. But when I saw the description of how it was done,
you're talking about like how the indexing of the file system was working?
Right, mm-hmm. how it was made. Because it wasn't that much code. It didn't make sense to me. And more to the point, there were aspects of the Linux kernel that I thought, okay, if I applied myself, if I work hard, I could do some of these things that I'm seeing described in front of me. And when Git came out, the thought occurred to me, if I had sat down for dozens of years, I don't know that I would ever think to do this.
I wonder if that holds you back.
The thinking that way?
Yeah, because I mean, you and I, Lyle, have talked about this before. I have a basic belief, even though I didn't think I was that smart compared to all my friends, I have a basic belief that if I applied myself to anything, I can do it. I don't know if that is a true thing for every person on the planet. I mean, it can't be, can it? But I do have that inherent belief that if I want to do it, I know I could do it eventually.
I have that hubris, like I said, about the Linux kernel, which is a vastly
more... He just called that hubris, by the way.
It could be ignorance as well, yeah. But maybe it makes things possible that somebody who feels they could never achieve it wouldn't achieve.
See, this is where I think it's different, that I don't take it as, oh, I could never do something like that. It's, I was confronted with the solution and went, that was completely out of scope for how I would approach mm-hmm. that problem. Like, it just wouldn't have occurred to me to go back and revisit it that way. It was off the radar.
Now, keep in mind, though, you're comparing that to one of the Gausses of our day, right? Trevallis is...
I don't know that I call him a Gauss, but yes,
he's a genius. I mean,
yeah, he's a remarkable person. Yes, a very remarkable software engineer. And
the thing is, now that you gain that idea, do you understand it? Could you implement it? Could you use it?
I do understand it a little bit better, but I would be very hard pressed, even after having used Git for this period of time to know a little bit more about it, to redo it myself. I honestly would. And then I think of the example of the hierarchical comment system, thread system that I was talking about, or the viewing the file system mm-hmm. through Unix commands, stuff like that.
There was times in your career you wouldn't have thought of that.
I don't know about that.
The thing is,
it would have been the same category of issue.
I don't know if I've run into a problem like that where I went, oh, I wouldn't have ever thought this. I think I normally take – that's probably hubris. I normally take on something like that I didn't think of that I found and go, oh, yeah, it makes sense. And then I consume that into my psyche and go, yeah, I'll move on from here. So maybe I should look at harder problems. I think also, though, the Git is a really great example. I recall at one point just being like, how do I get this? And like using it for a week or two and then going, no, I don't get it exactly. What does rebasing actually mean? And then over time using it for years, I no longer have a fear about it. I much more have a, oh, yeah, what was that command? Oh, I can do this. Wait, how can I keep these two files and not these?
That's using Git versus understanding
totally,
like, it is actually implemented.
But the state of not understanding how Git actually even ran, I remember sure. that feeling.
Yeah.
And that feeling is completely foreign to me.
I mean,
me
don't we feel that feeling every time we encounter a novel problem?
Like, it feels that way, but Miles might be talking about something else.
I think you are, right?
Yeah, and maybe it's just something that I have forgotten from my past because, you know, sitting in college learning calculus, for example, there were related rates. I remember being a topic specifically that my brain kind of bent wrong when I thought about it. Everyone has that topic that hurts them.
I don't know why, but for me, linear algebra was that. When we got to domains, mm-hmm. My brain just did not compute, did not grok it.
So, Miles, if there's a point at which you, a senior engineer, really good at programming, like know your stuff, teach people, like mm-hmm. people go to you all the time for expertise in programming. If you look at a problem and say, wow, I never would have got that. That's something that's maybe outside of the brain, my scope. Don't you think there's other people, and possibly quite a few of them, that feel that way about a simple for loop? I mean, when I say simple, for us, the four of us, simple for loop. See, I'm just wondering where on the bell curve we are. If you look at the amount of people that are software engineers right now versus the amount of people we need and the profession it grants you, the money and the prestige it grants you, you would think that there would be a lot more people that could do this.
Aside from the very early part of my programming education, being formal, the computer science AP classes in college, just going up to like data structures, not going very far. If I had a full education, like a bachelor's degree in computer science, I don't think it would have been as inaccessible to me as it was. I don't think that it was a fundamental fault of my brain. I think of it more along the lines of my career trajectory as it's taken, my education trajectory as it's taken me. I would not have thought of that. And Linus Torvalds himself, I mean, had a degree in computer science. He did not come up with a lot of the algorithms dealing with acyclic graphs, which is directed acyclic graphs, which is what Git is single directional acyclic graph.
He borrowed those from academia.
Yes, so he learned those, and he was able to assemble. He was given blocks.
I was just gonna say that you took it out of my brain.
Yeah,
yeah. So he had different blocks than you had when you were reading the Git source.
And I think he's smarter than I am. I think he is further along that bell-shaped curve than I am, sure, quite a bit.
In just raw intelligence, whatever the heck that means.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing to say, just because it depends upon what you're talking about. In the area of computer engineering, very specifically, especially as it deals with, say, C code, yes, he is head and shoulders beyond me.
So there's two places that – there's three places this conversation could go. It can end and we can talk about cryptocurrency. We can talk about IQ and bell curve of just general intelligence and how this same problem correlates potentially to those problems, because it's typical for engineers at a senior level to have above average human IQs. And then we could also just go into the third thing that I forgot what it was going to be.
Are you thinking about the thing that I suspect you weren't thinking of that I'm thinking of?
Possibly. What is it?
I just had this fantastic experience over the weekend where, so actually, let's just go into it. I'm just going to tell the story.
Wait, is it changed topic completely from this?
No. No, it's, okay, good. It's very much the same thing.
All right. Well, this is the third choice of the conversation then. Ben?
The third option is the thing I was thinking about that I suspect you weren't thinking about. Yeah, I had this really fantastic experience, which this conversation is reminding me of. This weekend. We're recording on Monday. And so for the last year, there's this internal tool that we've been using. It's at work. It's a web app. It's React, Redux, some particular type of architecture that I wasn't too familiar with on top of that. And it was originally built as a test bed for this type of architecture before we built something else with it, right? So we used this architecture, mocked it up, built this internal tool.
It's like a sketch.
Sure, yeah. So someone else, another front-end engineer, built this. And then he left the team. And then 6 months later, so it got this bug in it because we changed some of the things it relied on. And my life got a little bit worse because I was constantly contending with this bug. And then another 3 or 6 months go by, and then the bug gets worse because we change some more things that it's relying on. It becomes this tool starting to become really unreliable and all of this stuff. And a couple times during this entire period of time, I opened it up to try to understand how it was working and maybe I could fix this bug. It's a really simple seeming bug.
But you have no experience with React or Redux.
I have experience with React.
Okay, good.
I understand conceptually Redux. I didn't understand the architecture that this person had put into place.
It's so funny because when you say React and Redux,
that's kind of an architecture.
Done. Yeah.
But
there's something else.
Yeah, there's some other things. I don't want to get too far into that because I don't have any words for it.
It's radio.
Because it's not a library. It's choices that a person made with an idea, a concept in their head. And that's not documented anywhere, right? So I'm reading this code and trying to understand why is this the way it is? How does it work? And how do I make changes without breaking it? On top of this, it's got Flow in it. Flow is a type checker. It's kind of like TypeScript, but it's a different one. And I had not used Flow before. I had used a little bit of typing before, but not actually all that much. I've mainly done JavaScript. So all of this to say, I'm trying to read this code and it's just really not going well. So I give up. And then a couple months later, I try to read this code and fix this stupid bug again and it's just not going well. I can't remember who said this. Maybe I think it was you. You said maybe that hurts you. You said to Miles earlier on.
Yeah, maybe the feeling that this is too hard for you is holding you back.
Absolutely. I saw that feeling in some way in my mind. I like understood it as this meta thing instead of this thing that was part of me. I can't do this. I've tried. And I can't do this. I saw it as this different thing, this meta thing, this thing that was impacting me rather than a part of me. So this weekend, I was having a wonderful weekend, but I pulled open my computer and I hacked at it for about an hour and I solved the bug. It was weird.
I love that it was on the weekend where you didn't have other pressures of things you were supposed to do. Right.
I felt like a failure working at this at work. And, you know, you spend half an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours hammering away at this thing and making absolutely no progress. And you feel like, wait, I'm getting paid to make impact on this tool. And I feel like a complete noob, you know? I don't know what I'm doing. So, yeah, I think it was a combination of luck that I happened to read the right portions to give myself the right mental model for understanding it, the lack of pressure, and also the seeing that, that like, I can't do this bit as something outside of myself rather than something that's part of me.
Sometimes it needs to percolate, too.
That's true.
There are times where I've had dreams before where a problem that I couldn't solve, and I will dream that I'm working on the problem because, like, your dreams kind of follow, I mean, you follow your day. And I will have solved the problem in a dream, and I'll wake up and I'm like,
yeah.
Like I also find that when I'm stuck at a problem, one of the best things I can do is go have a meal, go for a walk.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Take a shower.
Take a shower, do the problem the next day.
And the other one is bringing someone else in and saying, hey, I'm having a problem with this. And you start to explain the problem before they've even done anything. You're like, oh.
I got it. Yeah.
Rubber ducky decoding.
Yep.
Rubber ducky?
Or rubber ducky debugging, I mean. Yep. You put a rubber ducky on your monitor. Whenever you're feeling like I'm really not doing well right now, you just start talking to the ducky. You explain to the ducky everything that you're doing, the reason you're doing it, and you have that eureka moment.
You should make an app for that. Just pull up your phone and
go get a ducky.
No, like, no. Rubber's bad.
This is not just a programming thing. This is a cognitive science. They've found this that people who procrastinate writing an essay, for example, because they get the assignment, they think about the problem, and they just kind of let it percolate in their brain for a few days. And then the day before you need to have the essay done, you start typing, and things have kind of coalesced in your brain many times. And you just spit it out, and you're like, here you go. And
sounds like an excuse to wait till the last minute. The third thing, the third way I thought about taking this conversation before I
which
forgot
was not mine.
Which
mine
not
was
yours, because, of course, I couldn't have thought
mine
of yours.
Mine was the zero.
Yours was
zero,
the third,
zero,
now mine's the fourth.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah.
The last one is about free will and the possibility of the lack of a free will. And this is a philosophical argument about whether we actually have any ability to have a free will.
How long do you want to record tonight? Because I could talk about this for hours.
I know. It's
like,
it's a serious spiral. I do think we all need to go home at some point.
A rabbit hole.
But I just wanted to kind of clarify, like, the reason you solved that problem was that the first thing you said was luck, right? Which isn't really you.
Yeah.
But everything that we're talking about, of like why I became an engineer in general, was because of how I was raised and not that I had choice. Yeah. That a lot of what we do, and I would lean towards the idea that everything we do is actually input and output, and that we don't really control very much at all. And I think that that what you get in wisdom is the knowledge of your weaknesses and how to compensate for them, not to actually overcome them, but to how to work around them. For example, I, you know not to flirt with somebody when I'm in a relationship because that leads to me making bad decisions. And I've learned that very painfully over my life.
You told me one about gluten, about your diet.
Oh, yeah. So I just don't eat carbs. It's actually carbs.
Oh, carbs. Yeah. Okay.
But my family's gluten-free. In general, my house is, because someone's a celiac in my house. But I don't eat carbs very much anyway because of gaining weight really easily. But if it's late at night, and especially if I've had any alcohol, I will eat carbs.
Why?
Eat the kids' candy. Because
you've told yourself you're not going to, though, right?
Because I make bad decisions at night. So the trick I give myself is go to sleep. Just don't spend the late night and then
deactivate
go to the kitchen.
Yourself.
Just don't put myself in the kitchen where my inability to control. I can control myself from going downstairs, right? But there's a point at which I won't be able to. And it's not that I'll ever change that aspect about myself. I'll just make sure not to put myself in that situation.
I see.
Anyway. Free will is an illusion. Do you want to cover cryptocurrency quickly, comrade?
Don't be cryptic.
Sure. We're seeing some major drops in many cryptocurrencies.
In value?
In value. Bitcoin reached a high of 20,000 at its peak and is now below 7,000.
Oh, my God, my life savings. It's at 68.57.
Well, we laugh,
right,
but there
now
are some people who actually did do that.
Yeah, I actually felt bad making that joke just now because some people have done that.
There have been some notable hacks going in there. People have been finding vulnerabilities in the blockchain. So this eventual consistency database, because if you have someone, if you have the resources to be able to generate at least 51% of all of the hashing power out there, then you can start to influence what goes into that eventual consistency database, that distributed eventual consistency database.
And basically restrict sales and increase buys, things like that.
Like, or, you could change history.
Or, yeah, you can, more to the point, the issues that a lot of people worry about is being able to sell a coin twice and put it into the ledger, even though you should only be able to sell it once.
Because if the entire network is the most people who agree on a history, that's history. Mm-hmm. And then you control 51% of the
Right. Now, it wasn't necessarily about
that. To really understand what we're talking about, I urge you to listen to the episode of Geek Speak about cryptocurrency. It was early in this year, January, February.
Also a rabbit hole.
What's that?
Also a rabbit hole.
Right? Yes.
Now, this is not just affecting Bitcoin. It's affecting a lot of different currencies. In fact, the smaller currencies are more vulnerable because it's a lot easier to get 51% of the hash computing power of a smaller pool of items. And yet, it is causing some concern. There was a 42 cryptocurrencies lost $42 billion after a South Korean hack. And many different places have, with different currencies, have lost varying amounts of money due to hacks. And so it's come to the point now where, for example, Apple no longer allows cryptocurrency mining apps in the store. They were already banning certain types of cryptocurrency tools in there, but they're actually enacting a full-on ban now, saying you can't have a mining tool.
Not for your own virtual server. Or you're talking about for App Store, Apple's App Store.
Yes, for the App Store. And Wells Fargo is banning cryptocurrency purchases with the credit card.
Oh, interesting.
Which is signaling that they are saying someone's going to buy with a credit card this heavily depreciating asset, and they're doing so recklessly now that they can't pay it back.
Right.
Once you put stuff on a credit card, you know, that's already, you're not necessarily liquid enough to be working with that. And if you have something that is just going to be turned into thin air, essentially, wealth that turns into thin air, it's not even something like I'm purchasing a car on a credit card, which I don't recommend. But if you did that,
you could sell the car.
You could sell the car at a loss, but you could also use the car to go to your job. You can use the car to haul items. You can use the car for other things, whereas Bitcoin is exists for its own sake, for lack of a better description. And if it disappears, that it's just gone. There's no utility there. It's just gone.
Okay, so my question to you is, we've seen this before, haven't we? Is this pattern no different than what's happened in the past with Bitcoin?
Bitcoin has had its ups and downs. That is true. It is still much higher than it was 5 years ago.
In the past, I remember the pattern I'd see is there would be a quick crash over the course of a few days or weeks, and then it would just stay at that same value for a year or two, and then starts climbing up faster and faster, and then we have another spike and another crash.
Right. But now you're seeing, because it has so much volume, you're seeing governments say, I don't know if you want to be involved with this. You're seeing banks, you know, saying you can't use certain methods in order to exchange. It's basically what it is you're using a credit card to exchange dollars for Bitcoin. And you're also seeing regulators looking at it going, wait, you're an exchange. And the New York Stock Exchange has rules and regulations, and the Nikkei Index has rules and regulations. But all of these various places where people are trading Bitcoin don't have those regulations. So you're seeing a lot more scrutiny there too.
It's the market's going to mature. Yeah.
Yes. And so will it absolutely disappear? And this is something we talked about before. Will it absolutely disappear? I don't think so. But the gold rush, I feel, is...
is over.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was this December, I think, when it hit 20,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Miles, you've got one last story about space. The final frontier. I'm sorry.
New Horizons.
Ben, you didn't do the music for me.
I forgot my trumpet at home.
Okay, sorry.
New Horizons was the spacecraft that gave us pictures of Pluto for the first time. But it's still going. Going very fast. Fastest vehicle, man-made vehicle that we've ever created. The New Horizons probe, after it flew by Pluto a few years ago, still going. So you go, what's beyond Pluto? Who's going to ask what's beyond Pluto?
What's beyond Pluto?
There is a great deal of objects out there beyond Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, of which Pluto is a member of. One of the things they're going to be looking at is something they've affectionately called Ultima. Ultima Thule, officially named 2014 MU69.
God, I love these names.
So after it passed New Horizons, they were already angling it to see this object. Obviously, you have a limited range for what you can do. You can't just stop it on a dime, take a hard left turn, and go where you want to go.
And around Albuquerque, yeah.
Right. So they figure out what are the candidate spots that we can go to after that, and then they go. They are still 6 months away from the object, but they woke it up. And you may ask, why did they wake it up?
They wake the object up, or they woke the craft up?
Woke the craft up.
Okay.
They wanted to take pictures of something.
Because when you have something that far away that had been so recently identified, its exact trajectory and orbit are very hard to calculate. Oh. And so you have to wake it up, look, make observations, and then make any course corrections way ahead of time because it takes a lot less fuel. The longer you wait, the more it costs in terms of fuel and the like.
So it has to drive.
It has to. And also, you know, checking all the systems, like how is everything going? Let's do some diagnostics and make sure that you're on course. So,
how are you day? How's your day been?
Yeah.
How's your year been?
Yeah, it's been a few years since you saw Pluto. You know, did you have a nice nap?
I want to upload a podcast so you can listen on your space flight.
That'd be the worst thing to do in an general artificial intelligence.
Wouldn't that just
send it off into space and not give it propulsion
system? It would be horrible if we learned that it was actually sentient.
So New Horizons showed us the first pictures of Pluto. It showed us the most distant, a close-up view of the most distant body ever. Like we've seen stuff from telescopes, but never a close-in view that we could see with direct photography. And soon, in 6 months, we're going to see something that's even further.
That's so cool. Is this thing bigger than Pluto?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not even
close. I'm just curious why it was called what it was. What was it called again?
Ultima Thule.
Sounds big.
Well, aren't there objects out there?
It sounds like a lisp when you say it. Ultima Thule.
There is objects in the Kuiper Belt that are bigger than Pluto. Yeah,
yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. Orbits the sun approximately a billion miles beyond Pluto.
It's a long ways.
Which is kind of hard to measure because Pluto has a really irregular orbit.
Yeah, they're probably average. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can do anything you want with this. You can remix it. You can make money on it. Just give us some credit.
And don't copyright it.
The title for today by Greg Merkley in Canada is Public Domain Brains Program Siri. Thank you, Greg, for the title. And thank you, Miles Elam, Brian Young, and Ben Jaffe for joining me today on GeekSpeak.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
I got a post-show thing to say. All this talk of pedantry. Shortly after...
This is precisely the sort of pedantry up with which I will not put.
Shortly after, Miles said, of which Pluto is a member of.
Is that
And
correct?
That's why I went like, oh, did anyone else hear this? I'm looking at you, both of you. Nope. Just.
Is that incorrect? That's not incorrect. That's
of which Pluto is a member.
Period. Oh, what he? Oh, he did two ofs.
Of, yep. Yeah.
Two prepositions. I doubled my prepositions.
You put the of at the beginning to sound special. I'm smart. I say of which Pluto is a member. Of.
I love that you waited for the after show. So you're actually
I didn't want to interrupt him. You've been interrupting everyone.
I think you should have interrupted him right away.
No.
I love that you kept it.
No, I've got respect for that man.
I love you.
Even though he has no respect for me.
What are you talking about? Something I didn't bring up on the show was...
The second of.
Was when we were talking about intelligence and where we may fit into the grand scheme of things on any given topic. I often wonder if, for example, Ben has a leg up on us intellectually. You're a smart guy. Because you are young enough that leaded gasoline had already been phased out.
It's actually pronounced leaded gasoline. But I understand what you're saying.
Come on. Wow, the title of the show is really spiraled quickly.
You encouraged him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, this was, brought this up before, that we grew up in a time when we'd smell leaded gasoline.
But we were, what, 6 or 7 before it was finally phased out? And those are the years where you are most susceptible to the issue. So it was in the air. It was on the ground. Anytime you, like, touched the ground where there was, like, some residue.
And licked it.
When it showed up in the water supply, like in the reservoirs, because I grew up in the LA area, or anytime you live in a
and any level of lead in the environment, it's bad, right?
But I have mentioned that to friends. Like, do you think you might have been just like a little bit smarter? Like, you would have gotten a couple of more questions right in the various tests you've taken over the course of your life if we had not been exposed to leaded gasoline.
So what you're saying is if you hadn't been exposed to leaded gasoline, if you had been born the same time as Ben, you wouldn't have made the second of mistake.
That's quite possible.
So basically he's saying, Ben, you have no excuses.
Oh, no, that is not what I am saying.
Oh, good.
I am saying that this may be a justification why Ben is smarter than we are.
Hmm. Leave it to you to turn it into an insult.
It's not. I'm just saying you have no excuses. You don't need them because you're always right about things.
Oh, I make plenty of mistakes.
Like to sign and be on this podcast with us today.
I know, yeah. I only came for Brian. But...
Does it make you uncomfortable to talk about intelligence?
It with you guys?
It makes me uncomfortable. Yeah. And like you, one of the possibilities was talking about IQ. I'm completely uncomfortable talking about IQ.
That's actually why I was happy to go with one of the other choices. Yeah.
But the reason why I'm uncomfortable with it, because I just don't see it as being an outweighing factor to accomplish something.
Yeah. Oh, I fully disagree with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you look at predictive qualities on successful user interface engineers, for example, or programmers in general, the best predictor is IQ.
We've talked about this, and I was uncomfortable then. And honestly, I don't even understand what IQ is measured as.
Well, it does correlate with programming capability skill. That doesn't mean anything but that, right? I mean... Doesn't mean you're a better human being
so
or a worse
somebody
human being.
Created a scale to make them feel like a good programmer?
No, it just happens to correlate well with success in programming. I don't know if that – I mean, so therefore it's probably a useful tool to assess whether you should hire a programmer.
Well, also a useful thing is if you are good at music, you could be good at programming. I firmly believe that if you can grok music, if you can play the piano appreciably well, if you can read music and play at the same time, even if it's at a – marginal level, if you can, if you've ever been part of a band and had some aptitude.
Do you play any music?
I took piano lessons when I was younger, but I never got to the point where I could read music and play at the
same
time.
It's so funny. I would assume Ben, as the musician in the room, would profess that.
Music and intelligence?
No, music and programming.
IQ, music and programming?
It worked for IBM. IBM, the first programmers, if you had a training in mathematics or if you had training in music, mm-hmm. they found correlations with people having aptitude with programming. Simple steps that can be combined in novel ways.
Right.
When you're programming and when you're playing music, does it feel similar to what your brain's doing?
Let me think about that. It doesn't feel the same. Although I do sometimes type along to the music.
You type along to the music? So like the rhythm you have?
Yeah. The other day, Luz was like, are you typing to the music? I'm like, yeah, of course.
Why wouldn't you? It's
why not? Yeah. And like I've improvised on piano to something that I was playing by ear while reading a book. And that doesn't feel like work to me. So I don't know. There's something, some way about... Okay, so actually, talking about this topic that we were talking about before around like, are some people more likely to be able to program and some people less likely. I definitely think that's true for music. I don't think that I feel the same way, basically.
Are you saying some people can do music and some people can't?
No. I'm saying most people fall in that middle area, and some people are closer to one side and some are closer to the other. My entire family is really good at music intuitively, not because they've studied it or anything like that, but I took 7 years of piano. My sister took 5 years of piano. My brother Adam took 3, and my brother Sam took 1. And we all, like, aside from me, I picked it up and ran with it. Everyone else stopped. And they're all roughly the same, and they're pretty good, and they can play by ear roughly. But, like, they never were taught to do that. They just kind of picked it up. And then there are other people who are, like, classically trained musicians who have dedicated their lives to it, and they can't play by ear. So, like, there's something about the way that my family's brains are organized.
Sorry, what does play by ear mean?
Listen to something and then be able to turn around and just play it.
Oh, okay.
Rather than have sheet music that you're reading it, right? So I think there's something about the structure of people's brains that make them more or less adept at certain things. But
that's not an argument. The question is whether you can change the structure of your brain.
I think you can learn to play by ear, but I don't think you can necessarily learn to play by ear really well.
Your family is also exposed to one another as well over the years. So as one started to get it.
I grew up in a musical family and kept on hearing.
The patterns.
Not my dad. My dad has the same intuitive nature around music, and both of his parents did not play music.
That's not what I mean.
Horrible singers.
By the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles rule-based system written by Palladium, it's clearly easier to learn a skill if you have a sibling that's also learning that skill. So that's
sure.
Totally.
Yeah. They were artists too.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle names were artists.
Yeah, you should have seen the
of course,
top
when they made pizza.
You should have
artists.
Seen the top of their sewer.
It was beautiful.
Like, yeah.
So fun
these murals.
Fun little tidbit.
I also feel uncomfortable talking about music, by the way, for a similar, I don't know.
You feel uncomfortable talking about music? He feels uncomfortable talking about IQ?
I feel uncomfortable talking about the fact that I'm good at music and what might contribute to it.
So, okay, just to finish that up. Sorry,
I didn't mean to interrupt.
We have like 3 trains going. Go, Brian, go.
Staff,
well,
yeah.
Well, no. So I'm a trained artist. I went to art school. Yeah. I completely believe anybody can learn to draw and learn the skills to see something and draw it. And most people are completely afraid of drawing. So, I don't know. Take it for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm. So to sum up, Miles is a really good programmer and thinks everyone can program. Brian's a trained artist and everybody can learn to play, can do drawing. Ben's a musician and thinks everybody can do music. And I basically think no one can do anything. Because, okay, I'm sorry.
Does that mean you win the biggest ass?
Yeah. Miles, I think, were you done with the training? Look,
I'm done.
Yes, okay. Miles,
so,
back to
fun story.
Thanks for waiting.
Personal anecdote. 19 or 20 years old, something like that. Alex Leas, the Southern California correspondent for
DC. We know who he is.
For the anyone who might be listening.
Oh, we're recording. My God.
He was visiting me at UCSC in the dorms, and I remembered looking at a bit of code.
Yes.
And I did not realize that my brain was doing this, but I was looking at the screen. It's like a, green on black screen or white on black, something like that. And so old monochrome, black and white monitor, a monochrome monitor. And when I was looking at code, it was C, if memory serves. Different parts of the code had different colors as I looked at them. Like braces were blue and some words were...
They didn't actually, right?
They weren't actually.
Like in the physical
synesthesia.
World, everything was green.
It was absolutely synesthesia.
Wow.
And I was looking at it going like, yeah, and it's got like a green haze around the...
around everything because it's got its green.
No. I mean,
you experienced synesthesia. You experienced
yes,
it in other
I
parts
did.
Of your life.
And I remembered. Play? And the thing is, I was going like,
wait
yeah,
a second, wait a second. You were at UCSC.
I was not altered in any way.
All right.
And I remembered because I had actually gotten used to it. Like, it was that there was this thing there. I remember turning to Alex and mentioning, like, yeah, the little halo color that's there. And he's looking at me like, what are you kidding? Like he gave me the look of, like, are you messing with me?
So was that the first time you were confronted with this?
Yes. And bear in mind, I'd only been programming for maybe a year at that point.
Anyone can learn to program if you have synesthesia capabilities to code.
No, but that's the funny thing, though, is that it only started soon before then. And it was just kind of like, huh, that's really odd.
Your
Does it still
brain,
happen?
Your brain
and
invented...
And it stopped happening soon after.
Well, that's because we got syntax highlighting.
Color monitors.
But that's the funny thing is, it happened before syntax highlighting, so I wasn't like transposing something I'd seen somewhere else.
In fact, you were the Torvald of syntax highlighting. You came up with this idea. Like, who would have thought?
So I know
color the braces? That makes no sense.
But it stopped happening, and shortly after, like, I mean. Shortly after I pointed it out and he like mentioned it, I never saw it again.
You broke your ability to do it.
Yeah. But I do know that I'm able to see blocks of text in much the same way as when you read. You don't read every single letter. You read not just complete words, like the shape of a word, but shapes of phrases. We all do.
I read every single letter.
Everyone that has a modicum of literacy who's been trained since childhood does this.
That's why you can do those things where you can replace some characters in the right. word with a letter that looks like that character and you're still reading.
Or drop all vowels.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where I think skill with programming comes in, is more and more you're not looking at the individual symbols. You're not looking at the individual keywords anymore. You're seeing these blocks, and that's where the speed comes about. And that, I believe, are the leaps that you get to become a better programmer. Mm. Is that,
and you think everybody can do that?
With time, yeah. Just like everyone has sight words that they read for literacy, for basic literacy.
Okay. Earlier you were talking about typing with music. So I have been blacksmithing, and every once in a while I'll fill in for my mentor, Frank Golding, who is the blacksmith at Roaring Camp, which is a train depot.
You're doing blacksmithing, and you're filling in for someone?
Yeah, I'm filling in for him. Yeah,
that's really cool.
So
you've been doing this for a while then?
Since December, but I'm not real skilled at it.
6 months?
Yeah, but I've been making stuff for a long time, so I'm just picking up on the skill. So I'm filling in for Frank. He's on vacation for the month, and there's a few people filling in. I just did this the last 2 days on the weekend. And I'm going along just forging away. And when you heat up steel in a coal forge and you bring it over an anvil, the steel, of course, is very hot, and it's glowing orange or a little bit less than orange red. You put it down on the anvil to strike it, and as it's on the anvil is just conducting all the heat and just pulling all the heat away from it. So you're basically trying to go as fast as you can by hitting something with a hammer to shape it into anything you want. Sometimes you're using other implements like chisels and things to mark it. And all of this requires you to not touch it because it'll burn you very badly. I failed. See my big burn mark?
Yeah,
it really hurt.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, but I kept working. It's because I grabbed something accidentally, because, of course, your brain is like, catch things.
That's the worst instinct when you're doing blacksmithing.
It wasn't a catch. It was in a vise, and I wanted to readjust it slightly in the vise. I had to loosen the vise, and I grabbed it and heard the sizzle sound before my body actually reacted. Horrible. In any case, the entire time it's a performance because you have people around you asking questions. There's little kids, and you're talking with them, and you're making jokes like,
oh, wow, this is a public thing.
Oh, it's completely – it's mostly – like the reason why they're paying me to be there is to have a blacksmith on site showing them the era. You know, it's kind of a throwback era. There's, you know, a steam engine that you can go on rides, and then there's a print shop that's contemporary to the steam engine, and there's a blacksmith contemporary to the steam engine and so on.
Do you wear a top hat?
I don't. No, I'm a blacksmith. I have long hair and a big leather robe.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Or a leather vest.
So you're in costume.
Yeah, I'm in costume because I look like the way I do. I have long hair and sideburns. So it's perfect. In fact, somebody came up and was like, oh, you're really dressing the part. Your hair is perfect. And inevitably, people ask me things like, you do this for a living? And I go, no, I'm a software engineer. And they're like, whoa. And it always throws them. I love it. In any case, so I'm working along and I'm talking to the audience and pounding at steel quickly. So my body actions are not something I'm planning and thinking about because I'm just trying to make that metal the shape I want to make it prior to it getting too cold. And I'm talking to people. And at the time, there's a band playing. There's this great guy. His name's Sheriff Jim, And every day he brings his white horse and he parks it far away from where people are, his van, in his trailer. And then he rides his horse in full cowboy regalia. He's got a sidearm. He's got all this paraphernalia and a guitar. And he sets up and plays music and talks with people. He's great. Every once in a while, he'll come over. He's like, oh, I need a nail. And I give him a nail that I've made, you know. And he goes off and pretends to do something. But it's a total blast. But he had a whole band, him and like three other people, playing music a little ways away from me at his shop. And sure enough, at one point, a woman goes, why are you banging to the music? And as soon as that happened, I couldn't do it anymore. It was like messing with me. But I had been like rhythmically not only striking with my hammer at the beats, but rotating the thing I was working on back and forth at a beat as well, like a second beat. And I totally realized this. And then when I got home later, I was doing some more work. I turned on music to help me and get into a rhythm. So it wasn't just that it was unconscious, but at first it stopped me from doing it. And then as I used it, it got me back into an ability to think less about what I was doing and more about what I wanted to do. I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, I got that with running too.
Okay, you've done crafts forever. Do you ever get into that feeling of flow? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. It was helping me get into flow. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What's flow? I got to be the person to ask. You
well,
know?
No. I'm just trying to think about it. It's that sense.
It's a typing thing, right, for JavaScript. But... Sorry.
It's that sense that you're not actively controlling everything. You're feeling your way through it. And when you're in the flow, things are pretty easy, right? They come pretty easy.
Yeah.
There's not as much thought. There's more of feeling your way through what you're doing.
You're not thinking about what you're doing the same way. Yeah.
I would never be in the flow if I was stressed.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of catching things, though, one of the things I say with the crowd when I'm talking is that at one point, this kid wanted this fragment that had broken off, this leaf that I'd built, but I actually broke it off because I was working the material too cold. And so it fell off in the forge when I put it back in. So I pulled it out and I was cooling it off, and the kid wanted to look at it. So when it finally cooled off, I gave it to him, and then he kind of wanted to keep it. And it was like a little fragment, but the parents were like giving him a hard time about it, give it back to the guy and stuff. And so it finally got back to me. And then instead of just giving it to the kid, which I intended to do, I was like, hey, you're trying to take my leaf. And I pulled it out of the back of his ear because I'm like, I do little magic tricks, right? And then people were like, oh, my God. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a blacksmith, a juggler, and a magician. And they were like, yeah. And I was like, but juggling and blacksmithing is really bad because I tend to catch things. And then I had my burn mark. So I had like a whole comedy routine. It was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah.
The blacksmithing is definitely secondary. But I made the most complicated thing I'd ever made on Saturday, a fork. The simple fork, like that we use all the time, that we get plasticware, you know, they're everywhere, is extremely hard to forge in blacksmithing because the tines are so...
To forge? Yeah, I would imagine it's really hard to forge for forks.
I don't understand the joke.
Forge? Forage is to...
Forge. Oh, you're saying forage?
Yeah, I heard forage from you.
Oh, great. Because the tines of the fork are so thin and light that... bending them and then shaping them and stuff and back and forth. So at the end of a day, and I'm like all day, I worked on this fork. Oh, there's pictures of the GeekSpeak website. All day I worked on this fork. At the end of the day, Maggie's like, yeah, I did the laundry. I did this. I did that. I set up a sprinkler system. I got the kids, you know, doctor's appointment set up, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I made a fork today. We just laughed and laughed about how ridiculous that was.
Which is anyway. Funny. That's exactly how programming is.
You spend all day and you're like,
I got all these things done and I finally got the database to turn on.
It's totally true. What did you do today? I did half of a project I did yesterday. Was it a lot of lines of code? 14 lines of code in 24 hours? Yeah.
Well, I wrote 500 and then I deleted 512 and then I added 24 more. And
that's one of the things that sucks about Git. It's like... this many deletions, this many additions. And when they add up, you're like, I didn't do anything.
I was going to ask, that's a beautiful fork you made. We're low on forks in our house.
Can I make 12 more?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you could make 12 more. Now that you've done one, you should be able to do the rest really fast,
well,
right?
Well, I realize the actual trick in blacksmithing is that you make a prototype, then you make the tools necessary to make that item.
And then you make go to really IKEA, no. And then you get the 12 forks.
I could now spend
you rough them up.
I can now spend that's a day making a tool, a die set, and other things for myself to make forks, and then I could spit out a dozen forks a day by just
well,
by just doing a few tool sets that would help me with the tines and things of that nature.
Also like programming.
Also like programming.
Yeah.
Once you do it once, you can just copy and paste. Tools. Yeah. Definitely. Oh, you make your tools. Good point.
Going very fast. Fastest vehicle, man-made vehicle that we've ever created.
With reference to Earth.
Yes.
Well, of course, with reference to Earth. Come
with
on.
With reference to itself, it's not moving at all.
Yeah.
I just want to be clear.
Wait. I just want to point out that you were calling me a pedant earlier. In fact, you called me a pedant twice today so far.
Oh. It's very interesting that you counted that.
You want to edit out that little catty thing there? Okay.
this coming from Miles?
No, I'm leaving in.
So the New Horizons probe, after it flew by Pluto...